This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good morning. Thank you for joining me for another exciting episode of New Book Network's African American Studies podcast. I am your host, Katrina Anderson. Today, I am joined by Professor Sean M. Kelly, who is a professor of history at the University of Essex. He is a historian of New World slavery and the transatlantic slave trade. He has been involved in the Freedom Narratives Project, a collaborative effort by historians of four continents to collect, transcribe, and publish the autobiographical testimonies of Africans from the era of the slave trade. He was also the UK principal investigator for the Documenting Africans in the Transatlantic Slavery Datas Project, funded by the NWO and ESRC, which brought together scholars from four continents to recover materials on enslaved Africans and to build a biographical database. Professor Kelly has also written three books. His first, Los Brazos de Dios, a plantation society in the Texas borderlands, 1821 to 1865, was published in 2010. His second book, The Voyage of the Slave Ship, Hare, a journey into captivity from the Sierra Leone to South Carolina, was published by University of North Carolina Press in 2016. Today, we will be discussing his third book, American Slavers, Merchants, Mariners, and the Transatlantic Commerce in Captives, 1644 to 1865, which was published by Yale University Press in 2023. Thank you for joining me today, Professor Kelly.
Thank you, Katrina. It's a pleasure.
So, can you tell us a little bit about the book?
The book was really my attempt to kind of provide a comprehensive overview of American involvement in the transatlantic slave trade, by which I mean, you know, the participation in the slave trade by American merchants and mariners. It was a kind of a strange thing because it's the sort of book that a lot of people assume must have existed or must exist. But oddly enough, you know, there really wasn't any on this topic. So I've been working on, as you mentioned, a few other related projects, and I sort of decided it was time to, you know, to pull things together and to produce that book that really covered the whole of the topic.
So that begs the next question. How did you become interested in American slave trading?
Well, it's, you know, like a lot of people, I was very interested in American slavery, and the way that I kind of thought about that was, of course, you know, to focus on plantation slavery. And so when I was working on my PhD dissertation, I was writing about a particular region of Texas. I wasn't really thinking about the slave trade at all. Most American historians don't think a lot about the slave trade. They think about slavery. They think about the plantation system. And while working on that, I kind of stumbled into an unusual thing, which was the area that I was working on. It turned out, I hadn't known this at the start, was probably the part of the antebellum United States that with the largest illegally imported African-born enslaved population. It's probably 500 to 1,000 people there. And so that kind of set me down an unexpected path and you know, really forced me to look into the illegal slave trade of the 19th century, because it was, of course, slave trading in the United States was illegal after 1808. And I was able to develop quite a bit about this community of African-born people living in Texas. And so looking to do the next project, what I decided I would do is try to focus on really closely on the link between Africa and some part of the Americas. Because the one thing I wasn't able to really develop in the Texas project was some sense of should document with certainty where people had come from. So going into another project, the idea that I had was to really explore that link, but using some documents that could really nail down the case where you could know exactly where a person at least embarked on the African coast and where they wound up in the Americas. And I decided the way to do that would be to use slave ship records. So I wrote another book about just a single slave trading voyage that took place in the middle of the 18th century that had these wonderful documents really establishing those connections. And in the course of that, I think I worked through almost all of the major collections on the American slave trade in the 18th century. So I kind of naively thought, well, for the next book, I've done the 19th. Now, you know, I've done the 18th. It's just a matter of, you know, adding the 17th, and I've got a book. And it turned out to be very naive of me. There was an awful lot more to do. But the American Slavers, the book we're talking about today, is really kind of the product of all of those. It's sort of culmination of a lot of that research.
And you did it so very well. So I want to ask you, you have an interesting set of sources. Can you talk a little bit about those?
Yeah, there are a lot of different sources that I use. So some of these, a lot of them were the actual records from slave ships. So archival records, these would include letters written by slave ship captains. Those are very valuable. Things called trade books. So usually when a slave ship went to Africa, they would the captain would record every single exchange, every single purchase of a captive would go into a book. I worked a lot with those. There are archival collections from slave ships that were kind of key to this. But I had a couple of other things that I added to that. One of them is because, of course, I live in the UK, I was able to go to the British National Archives. And it turns out that there were an awful lot of papers from American slave ships in the British Archives because, as we all know, you know, Britannia ruled the waves for so long. And every time the United States and Britain got into some kind of conflict, say like in the 1790s or in and around the war, lead up to the War of 1812, the British would capture a lot of American ships, including a few slave ships. So I was able to get some brand new sources on that. But the other thing that I worked with here were narratives by enslaved Africans. As you mentioned in the introduction, I've been involved for quite a while in a couple of different related projects in which we collect narratives of Africans who were enslaved during the era of the slave trade. And there's a kind of common misconception that these are very, very rare, or they perhaps don't even exist at all. What our point has always been is it kind of hinges on what you define as a narrative. If a slave narrative to you means a book-length narrative like the life of Frederick Douglass, well, then that's true. Then no, there aren't very many by Africans. But if you expand the definition a little bit and you just want to take in much shorter narratives, so some of our narratives are, you know, maybe a page, not even a page, sometimes four or five sentences. If you accept that as a narrative, if you accept things that are not necessarily even written in the first person, maybe they're on a told-to basis. I met this African person and he told me what had happened to him. We consider those to be narratives. So if you expand that definition a little bit, you get quite a large pool of narratives. 600 would probably might even be approaching 1,000 with those. And I used them in the book, particularly in one of the chapters, to talk about pathways to enslavement. How did people become enslaved? How did they ultimately find themselves in the holds of these slave ships? And really the only way to get at that is through, because you know, slave traders don't care, right? They don't care how a person wound up being sold to them. That's not of interest. The only people who really care are the people themselves. And the only way you can kind of get at a lot of those stories is through those narratives. So I have a whole chapter that's built on those.
And we'll most definitely talk about that. I want to ask you, was there anything that surprised you during the research process?
Not a lot. As I said, I've done quite a lot of work on this, going into it. Of course, I mean, years ago, as I got into this, I was surprised by a lot of things. I think this is my third book on this, so I sort of knew what to expect. But one of the things that comes to mind, though, when I was first getting into the study of the slave trade, was how incredibly violent it was, and how difficult slave trading was. I think one of the impressions that a lot of us take away from textbooks and things like this, I mean, very often the slave trade, when you're reading your American history textbook, it might be presented as a graph, you know, this graph in which these numbers are getting higher and higher and so on. And I think one of the impressions, or the other familiar thing, would be like a map with big thick arrows showing you how, you know, where people were taken across the ocean. And the impression you can get from those graphs and maps is that the slave trade was this kind of simple, easy process. You know, maybe Europeans just show up with ships and a bunch of junk, and Africans fall all over themselves to sell somebody into slavery, and the numbers go up and up. And one of the things that, you know, if you really get into this field and you really get down onto the ground and look at this process, is you're struck at how difficult this process was. African merchants were not naive. They were not, you know, they were very aware and sophisticated. They did not take any old junk. They drove hard bargains. And that slave trading, as I said, could be violent, because what we're talking about here are establishing, you know, global connections between economies and Africa, economies in the Americas, perhaps Europe as well. And the interface, the points where those you know, people come into contact, that can actually be very violent. There's a lot of misunderstanding. There could be retaliation. And that was one of the things. So, you know, getting into this, just seeing how difficult, how violent, how conflictual slave trading could be in a way that doesn't come through in the charts and graphs was maybe the biggest surprise.
I wholeheartedly agree with that assessment, because you're right. When you think of the slave trade, it is always a, you know, chart or graph, and that's just how it's presented, and you don't understand the intricacies and the violence that is involved in this process, which is something that your book does a great job showing and explaining to people in more detail. So I want to ask you, there, you have this concept that you seek to engage with, which is ships going out and ships coming in. Can you speak about that distinction?
Yeah, that's a very, very important distinction. One of the things I learned, in the years that I've sort of been working on this, is that a lot of historians, and here, I mean, I'm not just talking about, you know, sort of general public, or I'm talking about professional, you know, PhD, sometimes very senior historians in the field of slavery, know very little about how the slave trade worked. It's kind of surprising. And I kind of devised this distinction here of between ships coming in and ships going out to really, you know, get a point across. And that is, when we're talking about the American slave trade, it can be very confusing because there were multiple things that we could call the American slave trade. When you say those words, American slave trade, to most people, they're going to think about as I say, ships coming in. They're going to think about ships bringing enslaved African people to the United States or to North America. And this is perfectly reasonable. There's, you know, totally natural to do that. But what a lot of people don't realize is that that slave trade was operated mostly by the British. So most of the people who were brought into North America arrived aboard British slave ships. There were, of course, American slave ships, but these ships sailing out of American ports, especially places like Newport, Rhode Island, mostly did not carry their captives from Africa to back to the United States. They carried them to the Caribbean. So what you have here are two kind of distinct slave trades. So if you said ships coming in, this is a British slave trade, bringing people into North America. Ships going out, this is an American slave trade that carries people, for the most part, to the Caribbean. There is a little bit of overlap sometimes, but most of the time they're very different. And so I devised that distinction. It's a really important one to recognize. I devised that to just kind of help people think through this issue. Just what is the American slave trade? What are we actually talking about here? My book, of course, is about the ships going out iteration of the American slave trade.
Thank you. That was a great distinction that you made. And you're right. People really don't take that so much into consideration as they're thinking about what that meant during this time period. Now, there's something else that your book does that's really, really important. Actually, your book does a lot of important things. But Africa plays a central role. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, there was a time, you know, a long decades ago, let's say, when people wrote about the transatlantic slave trade without really writing about Africa. You know, of course, everybody knew the ships were going to Africa, and you might get some discussion of, you know, what happened on the African coast. But it's really only until relatively recently that most people in this field have really realized how important it is to understand African history in order to understand the transatlantic slave trade. And I would really say you cannot understand the transatlantic slave trade without understanding African history. The quickest sort of illustration for this, and you know, African history, it's a vast field. It's a vast and complicated field with a massive literature. So it's hard to generalize. But what I would simply say is, the slave trade, it was not random, right? So American slave ships, for example, tended to go to two particular regions of Africa. They went to what we could call Upper Guinea, and they went to what we call the Gold Coast, that's in modern-day Ghana. And they didn't go to other places, for the most part. And the reasons for that have to do with Africa and its history. It has a complex regional history that meant that the slave trade was not distributed in a kind of random fashion all up and down the coast, but certain places emerged as centers for this, sometimes for one nation, sometimes for another, sometimes in one period of time. So you have the other thing you have in the transatlantic slave trade, because it went on for 400 years, is you have certain regions of Africa become important to the transatlantic slave trade in some eras and then not in others. And there's absolutely no way to approach those kinds of questions, fundamental historical questions of change over time, without actually looking into African history. So what my book really tries to do is to ask, you know, why did Americans go to these two regions? Why didn't they go to other regions? Why did they go to one in one time period and not another time period? And the answers to that tend to lie in African history and not in Atlantic or American history.
That makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense as to why you cannot find some of the answers that you would like. So now, let's kind of dive into your book a little bit. So how did New England get involved in the business of slave trading?
Well, New England, you know, it was the main slave trading region in throughout this period, you know, in the colonial era and then after the American Revolution. And the very first transatlantic American slave trading voyages came from Boston. And there was a kind of a fundamental underlying economic reason behind most American slave trading, certainly in the colonial period, but even beyond that. And that was that American colonists were almost perpetually in debt to British merchants. And they needed to pay British merchants in things that were called bills of exchange. So these were financial instruments. And the problem that all American merchants faced is that the demand for what was produced in America, there was really little demand for that in Britain itself. Certainly tobacco, not in New England. New England produced things like fish and lumber, and Britain just didn't need these things, right? They could export them elsewhere. But the New Englanders still needed to pay their debts. So the slave trade was one of the ways that they could, by sending vessels to Africa, and then by selling those captives in the British Caribbean. So as I said, most American slave traders go to the Caribbean. They were able to pick up bills of exchange that would allow them to pay the debts that they owed to these merchants in London. So there's a kind of underlying financial logic to an awful lot of the American slave trade that just goes back to this. And that's really what was going on from the very first American slave ship left Boston in 1644. And a relatively small number of slave ships sailed from New England in the second half of the 17th century. And in almost all cases, this was the goal, right? To sell captives in the Caribbean and then earn bills of exchange.
Now, we're speaking about, as you say, 1740s. What were the early traders like? 1640s. What were the early traders like in this period?
Well, they were kind of a grab bag of people. One of the things that you could say of the 17th century, the first decades of the American slave trade, is it wasn't carried out really on a regular basis. What you have here really would be the odd merchant in a place like Boston who, decides he's going to try his luck in the transatlantic slave trade. One thing about the transatlantic slave trade, unlike a lot of other trades, is it was a very expensive trade to get into. You need a lot of money, but you could also reap very big rewards. The problem is you could also lose a lot of money too. So it was a real roll of the dice for some of these merchants. But some of them were just going to try it out. And so what you see in the 17th century is just sort of the odd merchant seemingly just deciding, well, I'll give this a try. Maybe I'll get lucky and make a lot of money in it. The problem with that kind of thing is that slave trading requires a lot of experience. It's, as I said, it's not an easy trade to make a lot of money in. Lots of things can go wrong. Especially if you don't know anything about Africa, you don't know where you're going, you don't know how to deal with people. And so a lot of these early voyages were undertaken by people who had pretty much no experience, had no connections, didn't know what they were doing. I refer to them as kind of amateurs, bumbling amateurs. And it's almost sure that most of them lost money. And that creates a vicious cycle where, if you don't have people doing this on a regular basis, you never build up the experience and you never really get traction and it never becomes that kind of regularized profitable activity. And that's really what's going on in the 17th century. It's a lot of sort of random people are going to try sending out a ship every few years. That's what we have.
Wow. That's just so mind-boggling as you think about that. Now, things change by the 18th century, and how so?
Well, what happens in the 18th century is the slave trade becomes a regularized activity for New England merchants, and particularly for merchants in Rhode Island. Newport, Rhode Island becomes far and away the center of the American slave trade. And what made that possible was that these merchants you know, finally found something to trade in Africa. That's the other problem they faced in the 17th century, is there was nothing being produced in America that anybody really wanted in Africa. You know, they had tobacco there and they had fish. What happened, what really changed is in and around the year 1700, Americans start to import rum from Barbados, and they start to actually develop their own distilling industry. And rum would become the product, the trade good that enabled, would enable American merchants to become regular players in the slave trade, because rum actually had some kind of market in Africa. So so that's really what happens over the course of the 18th century. The Americans sort of really, you know, use this rum to purchase captives, carry them to the Caribbean. And the more that activity, the more they do that, the more experience they gain in the trade, the more they learn about Africa and its markets, the more they establish connections with slave dealers on the African coast. And rum's what allows that to happen. All this activity gets concentrated in Newport, Rhode Island, of all places.
Yes, that was going to bring me. So you've got the rise of these so-called rum men, and you have Rhode Island. So can you speak a little bit about how Rhode Island comes to play such a huge role in slave trading?
Yeah, I mean, it seems very unlikely, doesn't it? I mean, you know, Rhode Island is, you know, it's not big. but in a way, that's kind of the point, because the problem that Rhode Islanders faced going all the way back into the 17th century is that in economic terms, they were in the shadow of Boston. And, you know, so Boston merchants can get involved in all kinds of different trades. They can do very, very well. If you're a merchant in Rhode Island, your problem is that the Bostonians tend to dominate all kinds of other trades, and you can't really break in. So slave trading kind of emerged for these Rhode Islanders as a trade that they could get into that the Bostonians weren't really dominating. And then there's a kind of self-perpetuating quality to this. So once you know, say merchants in a place like Newport, Rhode Island, start to get, you know, involved in regular slave trading, what happens then is they build up the connections, and they build up the experience, and that they become the center for slave trading, and with all the experience and the connections. In a way, I mean, I compare it in the book to, you know, Silicon Valley. Why does Silicon Valley become this specialty area with all the expertise in coding or in chip manufacture? You know, it becomes self-perpetuating. And Newport became the place where, you know, even if you were a merchant somewhere else, like in Boston, and you wanted to send a slave ship to Africa, what you would probably do is hire a captain from Newport, because those guys are the ones who knew how this all worked, and it became very self-perpetuating.
Wow, that blows your mind when you think about that, because as you said, Rhode Island is so small, but I can see how the competition with Boston would lead them to try to stake out their own claim. So we're going from Rhode Island here. I'm going to ask you, what were the primary destination for American slavers in Africa? And did this change over time?
Well, for the most part, there were two, broadly speaking, two regions in Africa that the Americans went to. One of them I refer to in the book usually as Upper Guinea. And just to give you an idea, you know, modern day, we're talking about the area from modern day Senegal, but especially the Gambia, that became a very important place for the Americans, down to modern-day Sierra Leone. So this was the oldest, and if you want to think of it as kind of the original destination for American slave ships going all the way back into the 17th century. And there were a few reasons why Americans went there. One was that it wasn't dominated by another, you know, colonial power that was too hostile. Like, for example, if you think about Angola was a Portuguese colony. It was dominated by the Portuguese. Not going to send ships down there. It was also in terms of, you know, captive prices. So this again kind of here's why it's important to, you know, to connect with African history. They were actually able in a lot of times to kind of purchase smaller numbers of captives at lower prices there. The Americans are small-time players. I think that's another important thing to say. Their ships aren't very big. And so it's that kind of market that suited the Americans. It's also in terms of proximity to New World or Caribbean plantations. It's one of the shortest crossings that you can make in the Atlantic. And the Americans like speed. They like small vessels that move very quickly. So that was historically and throughout the American slave trade, Upper Guinea would kind of continue to be a place that they keep going back to. But in the 18th century, when rum really and Newport rose to the top, another region of Africa became the focus of the American slave trade, and that was what they called the Gold Coast. This is, of course, modern day Ghana, and probably a lot of listeners will be familiar with the very spectacular forts and castles that the Europeans built down in that part of Africa. And this became the main area. And in the 18th century, the Americans really, sometimes maybe even three quarters of their trade would go to this part of Africa. And it's a pretty simple reason for this, which is that it was this part of Africa that was most, the best market for the American rum. The market for rum in Upper Guinea was always limited a little bit by the fact that there was a Muslim community up there, which of course doesn't drink alcohol. So there's kind of a ceiling on that market. You can sell rum in Upper Guinea, but never that much. Whereas in the Gold Coast, the population is not at that time was not largely Muslim, and so there were no restrictions. And American rum came to be accepted into a lot of rituals and things within the economy on the Gold Coast. Even so, one of the myths I try to explode in the book is the idea that that there was this unlimited market for American rum. You sometimes see people saying, "Oh, you could, on the Gold Coast or in Africa, you could send as much rum as there as possible. People would just drink it." And this just isn't true. That's actually kind of a problematic thing when you think about it. Alcohol consumption off the charts. It's not really what happened. But rum did become a kind of ritually important in some areas. And that really accounts for it. Later on, what would happen is the Americans would get kind of priced out of the Gold Coast. So after the American Revolution, there were a lot of economic changes that took place in Lower Guinea, in the hinterland of the Gold Coast. And that meant the Americans could really no longer afford to work there. So they tended to shift. At that point, they shifted a little bit back toward Upper Guinea. They also tried to explore other markets. But it's a long and complicated history there. And I think it's really one of the best, arguments you can make for why you have to look at African history, because there's no understanding the shift in those markets without that.
Yeah, I agree with that wholeheartedly, because you cannot understand how the change over time takes place and why there are fluctuations. So in your book, it does a great job of explaining that, but it's also good just to have more knowledge about African history as well. So as all of this is going on, Rhode Island is, of course, thriving in this industry during this period. Then you have the American Revolution that takes place. How does that impact the slave traders?
Well, it shuts it down entirely. So once the American Revolution started, it basically all slave trading came to a halt for pretty much 8 years. There's nothing at all. Newport in particular is kind of an interesting history because as we all know, in the lead up to the American Revolution, there was a lot of, a lot of fuss about taxes and merchants and boycotts and the like. And one of the interesting things about the Newport group is that they basically ignore all that. So they're a bunch of scofflaws anyway. But the American Revolution starts at one thing that happens is the British occupy Newport. And so slave trader, you know, who's on the revolutionary side, pretty much left. There were loyalists who stayed, but the American Revolution just got wars tend to suppress slave trading. I mean, but once the British are patrolling the seas, potentially capturing ships, there's privateers out there. You know, you really don't want to risk losing an expensive slave ship with trade goods or with captives, however it might be. So it gets shut down for 8 years. When things restart after the American Revolution in the 1780s, the main change there is that the Americans, they won their war, they won their independence, and the consequence was that they deliberately took themselves out of the British Empire. So suddenly, you know, when the slave trade starts back up in the 1780s, you have these slave traders who used to trade, bring captives to the British colonies in the Caribbean, now have to try to figure out some other plan. And what really emerges as the alternative was Cuba, because around that time in the late 1780s, Spain was liberalizing trade with Cuba, and the Americans were going to take advantage of that. So there's a lot of shifts that take place in the American slave trade as a result of the revolution. Of course, the other is that there's now an anti-slavery movement, and that's something that the slavers are going to have to contend with as well.
They most definitely will. And one of the things that your book does a really great job, doing lots of things, but it's bringing in the perspective of the enslaved. Can you speak a little bit about their experience in captivity and what their experience was like on the slave ships?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that happens, you know, for any of us, which if you study the slave trade, one of the things that happens almost inevitably is that the documents that we use to, you know, to investigate, reconstruct the transatlantic slave trade are almost always documents that are produced by slave traders. And these are documents, by their nature, what they do is they treat people as commodities, as property. They enter the ledgers as numbers or as amounts or values. So to get around that, what I've done is turn to the narratives that I mentioned a little earlier. So one of the things the book tries to do is to use narratives to talk about, you know, how a person might lose their freedom and wind up in the hold of a slave ship, an American slave ship, or another slave ship. And this is a difficult question because slave traders don't care. they don't ask questions. They don't, you know, when somebody's delivered to a slave ship on the coast, the captain doesn't interview the person. And how did this happen? You know, where do you come from? And, you know, that's not their interest. They're not interested in that at all. They're interested in people as commodities. That's how they go into the ledgers. So you need these narratives to do that. And what really comes through here, I focused particularly on the two regions where the Americans were active, the Outer Guinea and then the Gold Coast hinterland, is that very often, there are any number of ways in which a person could lose their freedom. There were wars, and some of these wars were fought perhaps to actually procure captives to sell. But regardless, wars are disruptive. Wars create chaos. Armies pillage, and people get swept up in this. And one of the things that really comes through in the narratives is how precarious, you know, freedom can be in that kind of environment. Now, I say this, you have to remember, the vast majority of people living in Africa did not wind up enslaved on ships. I'm obviously focused on that particular group, but in story after story, narrative after narrative, you just get this feeling of this kind of insecurity. You know, the army came through and they scooped up a lot of people, and then they sold them on networks, walked people hundreds of miles down to the coast, put them on ships. Sometimes people were just kidnapped, because when you have an environment, when you have a slave trade, when there's a market for human beings, Some people are going to try to take advantage of that, and you know they will just kidnap children, especially, and just send them into the networks. And there were of course merchant networks that ran long distance trade in a lot of parts of Africa. So other than that, once a person arrived on an American slave ship. The American slave ships weren't really any different from anybody else's slave ships. So a lot of you probably, know a little bit about people chained and kind of packed in. The Americans more or less followed all of these things. But it was one little difference, which is that American ships were smaller than almost anybody else's ships. So they could be particularly miserable. And I had several examples of, these little ships that would get, the water would get in, the seawater would get in. Sometimes people would even, as a result of that, they might spend the whole voyage kind of soaking in salt water. And sometimes they would actually arrive, even though the voyage, of course, takes place in the tropics, sometimes they might arrive with, like, colds and pneumonia and things like that from having been exposed to the water. So it's a brutal, and harrowing experience. But as I said, I try to kind of trace it from the point of enslavement all the way to, delivery to the Americas.
And you did a really great job of showing that and illustrating that in the book. And something else that I found that was just fascinating was you discussed like the slave trading communities that develop, especially the one you made a little bit of reference to it earlier, Newport, Rhode Island. Can you say a little bit what that community was like and who was involved in the business aspect of things?
Yeah. So the thing about the slave trade is that, it tends to be a specialized activity. So that means that you have certain ports that are, regularly involved in slave trading. And in the context of American history, there are only two ports that you would ever point to say they were that regular as participants in the slave trade. So you can really say these are slave trading ports. And one of them, the biggest of these, of course, it is Newport, Rhode Island, as you say. And then toward the end of the 18th century, early 19th century, Bristol, Rhode Island, which is kind of near Newport, also became a major hub. And the way that I approached this, and to my knowledge, this is kind of new. I mean, I can't think of anybody else who did it. Is I was just trying to explore the ways. Or the question I was really trying to ask is, what difference did slave trading make? How were slave trading ports perhaps different from ordinary ports? And one of the things that really came out was the death rate, because another thing about the transatlantic slave trade is the death rates for sailors, for white sailors on these slave ships, was very, very high. They didn't have immunity to tropical diseases. And, often a slave ship might expect to lose almost 20%, 1 in 5 sailors. And so one of the interesting things is there was a kind of cumulative effect of this, where a community like Newport, and you spend 80 years sending ships out, you wind up, with a lot of dead young men. And it actually appears to have been enough to kind of throw off the sex ratio in Newport by at least a couple of percentage points, which, to me was significant. The other thing, two other things that happened, how slave trading ports different. One of them is that slave trading, of course, is such an elite activity that you get a kind of, you definitely get a hierarchy of wealth. Slave traders are by and large very wealthy people. They tend to dominate everything. The other thing that you get as a slave trading port is you get a very large enslaved population, a black population that's pretty big. And this happens because one of the practices in the slave trade was to let slave ship captains or the mates on slave ships buy captives for themselves and transport them essentially free of charge on the ship. And slave ship captains did this all the time. They might buy 4, sometimes 6, captives of their own, and they would bring them back. They could, of course, sell those captives. They probably did often, but they would also keep them. And so Newport had a you know, not just a large enslaved population, but the free Black population was sizable, at least at a certain point. And actually, at one point, it was the percentage of whites in Newport who owned enslaved people was higher than that of the antebellum South. In the antebellum South, on the eve of the Civil War, about 25% of all white Southern families were slaveholders. In Newport, that was about, it was closer to 30%. So that just gives you an idea. So these were also kind of slave societies in themselves.
And what's so fascinating about that is that we're talking about New England, that almost has, I think, as I was speaking with someone the other day, there's almost like this erasure
right.
of slavery and slave trading in New England. It's like, no, that's something that occurred below the Mason-Dixon line. But you do a great job of showing how, within Rhode Island, it's firmly entrenched there.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And it goes beyond just, the use of enslaved people, one of the kind of strange things that I realized with this is that the slave trade, in Rhode Island depended on having enslaved laborers just to keep it going. I mean, you needed people to grow, provisions for the trade. You needed people to distill rum for the trade. You needed people to rig the vessels. And, enslaved people were involved in all of those things in Rhode Island. So just to kind of keep the slave trade going, Rhode Islanders needed to kind of retain, a certain percentage of the captives that they purchased in Africa. So it's a circle.
That it was. So we've got this system that's been implemented. I want to ask you, were there ever any rebellions on the ships?
Yes. What historians estimate, this is difficult to pin down, sometimes given the nature, but the general estimate is that about 10% of all slave ships experienced some kind of rebellion or at least a conspiracy, an effort to rebel. And American slave ships, again, there's no difference in this regard between American slave ships and any others. We can't measure exactly how many rebellions there were, but there were certainly plenty, and we have lots of documentation for these, for some of them. And these were desperate, struggles to the death. And the vast majority of them, of course, ended in the deaths of the people who rebelled. Sometimes they would be cut down by, they used to, slave ships used to have these awful weapons called swivel guns, which were kind of like a little shotgun or maybe even a little artillery piece that was mounted on the deck. And they'd be cut down by those guns. Some people would be, when it became clear that the rebellion had failed, which as I say, most of them did, people would commit suicide. They would jump into the water, maybe a dozen at a time sometimes. And so these were harrowing affairs. They exacted a pretty serious death toll on the crew. Slave ship sailors were, lived in fear of these rebellions. And general practices on slave ships were almost always geared very closely to security, to making sure that people couldn't rebel. But even then, estimate is, like I said, 10%.
Wow, that is amazing. Are there any that kind of, for you, that stood out specifically?
Yeah, well, there was one that I was always, I thought was interesting. It was a story in which a guy got speared or harpooned in the water. One of the crew members, the captain, I think, had jumped overboard to try to get away because the tide was turning against him. He just got literally speared by a thrown spear or harpoon in the water. There are a couple of other interesting ones where there was an uprising and the rebels actually managed to seize the ship and sometimes run it aground. That would usually be in Africa. probably in most of those cases, people were just ultimately re-enslaved, I would think. But the one that really sort of stands out is the explosion of a slave ship off the coast of Africa, where the rebels detonated the gunpowder stores. 240 people aboard, all of them were killed. And it struck me that this is actually, you know, as far as I can say, it's probably the single most deadly rebellion in the history of American slavery. We always think about Nat Turner, of course, with, you know, give or take, you know, 60 whites killed. We're talking here about 240 people on that ship. So, yeah, I think so. One of the things that the scale of the slave trade, it just tends to be, because you're dealing with, on the average ship, you know, 100, maybe even 200 people. Things happen on a big scale.
That it did, and blowing up a ship, that's pretty large right there, bud. Desperate times call for desperate measures, as one would say. So that it did. So after 1808, you know, slave trading is officially, quote unquote, outlawed. How did that change the business per se?
Well, the immediate effect was that, you know, if you were a slave trader in the U.S., and if you wanted to continue slave trading, because some people just got out of the business. The other complicating factor is there was a big lead up. There's Jefferson's embargo, the War of 1812. A lot of things are going to kind of make it hard for slave traders to operate. But if you were a slave trader at that time in 1808, and if you wanted to continue operating, as some of them did, really what you would do is you'd move to Cuba. And so that's kind of what happened. Some of the major traders just shifted operations to Cuba. And what they did then is they just kind of operated as before. They, you know, they outfitted their own vessels in Cuba. They put rum in, you know, used rum. They would send them to Africa. Because by this time, Cuba was already a major market for American slave traders. There was a little difference there. So it was for a little while, they operated a bilateral trade almost as before. But within a few years, what happened is the Cubans learned the business. So the Americans moved to Cuba. I want to think of, you know, the Americans are the masters and the Cubans are the apprentices. But within just a few years, Cubans kind of gain the knowledge and the connections. And they wind up by about 1820, they wind up taking over the slave trade for themselves. And Americans continued to participate at that point, but they tended to participate as hirelings of the Cubans. So the Cubans, you know, would hire American captains sometimes. They would buy American ships. They would hire American crew. But after 1820, the Americans are really just sort of helpers in the Cuban slave trade.
Wow, that is so mind-boggling as you think about that. So, you know, they're essentially saying we're going to Cuba to do this now.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one other way to kind of say this is that the American slave trade after 1808 really is the Cuban slave trade. You know, now Cuba becomes the focus. There's a little bit of focus on Brazil. But it's very, very different from, you know, how things had operated before, where you had ships leaving from places like Newport. You really that becomes very, very rare. You have American ships for a while leaving from Havana to Africa and then kind of coming back. But it's very different from what had been operating before that point.
That makes a lot of sense. And, you know, it boggles my mind. I was thinking about the important role of Cuba the other day during the Civil War, and how some actual Southern masters and drivers would say you're going to be sold to Cuba. So that kind of as a deterrent
as a
for
threat,
them to escape.
Yes, right.
Yes, as a threat. So that makes a lot of sense now that Cuba, it assumes the important role that it played, that it develops during this time. So I want to ask you, were there ever any traders who, let's say, who were like outlaws who, you know, were still willing to trade, were there any that ever were severely punished for their crimes?
Yes. Well, so I think the larger story of American slave trading, you know, law and prosecution is that, you know, it didn't stop slave trading, really. It became, you know, illegal and a criminal act in 1818. And then in 1820, Congress strengthened the anti-slave trading law to equate slave trading with piracy. And what that implied is that slave, you know, if you were caught slave trading and convicted of slave trading, you could be executed. You could face the death penalty. And, you know, of course, you can see what the intention was for Congress. You know, they're serious. They want to end slave trading, so they're going to make it a capital crime. But the longer story is that didn't really work. It turns out, you know, probably we don't know what was in prosecutors' heads all the time, but they seem to have been pretty reluctant to charge people with capital crimes. Probably didn't think they could get convictions. Some of them may not have thought it was a serious crime anyway. So you do get people charged with crimes. Some people are spending a few years in prison here and there over the years. But nobody was being executed, you know, under that law, until finally, what it actually took was for Lincoln to win the election of 1860. Of course, Lincoln, as a Republican, was willing to be a lot more aggressive, and his prosecutors, his U.S. attorneys, were going to be a lot more aggressive, and so finally. In 1862, a man named Joshua Gordon was executed for slave trading. But even then, it was a little bit of a fight. He had to be tried a couple of times, and as it turned out, the execution didn't really deter the conviction didn't really deter slave trading. So just having that capital, you know, penalty there. Didn't really have a huge effect. Other things would end the American slave trade, but you know, prosecution, probably not really.
Wow, that's just, even with the threat of death, that was mildly enforced, or very leniently enforced. That did not stop it. It was such a profitable business enterprise during time, because you have to think it, even though, you know, and it's so hard to separate that out now. That this was, that you were dealing with people. And to traders, they are commodities.
That's right.
It's a business. It's a business, as is any other. And that's kind of the mindset that they had. It wasn't, you know, you're not thinking about families and friends being separated or kinship networks. No, it's about what is the profitability of this venture.
I mean, you almost have to do that. If you're going, you know, it's like a job requirement, you know, to be a slave trader, you have to be that kind of person. And one of the things I used to ask, you know, what did these guys have any moral qualms? I mean, as far as I could tell, the answer is no. They're not reflective people. They're not, you know, you don't, when you go through slave traders' papers, you don't get a lot of, you know, contemplation. You get a lot of dollars and cents. That's how they look at the world.
Wow. You know, and it's so interesting to think about that, because, you know, it's, you're taking out the humanity of all of this, but it's like, it brings down to how much does this person bring me?
Yeah.
What is their economic value? There's not much more here.
That's right.
I need to keep them alive, so I need to give them bare necessities, and they need to get from point A to B. But how much profit am I going to turn for this?
And I need to keep them alive in order to turn a profit. That's not a look.
Yeah.
You know, and just that. I mean, just, you know, make sure they're alive. That's the main thing.
Bare minimum. And they're in semi-good health, because I am going to sell them.
Yeah.
It's a commodity. That's what it boggles down to. So I want to ask you, what do you want readers to take away from the book?
I think what I'd like them to, you know, one of my goals with the book was to really introduce this discussion of slave trading to larger, discussions of American slavery. Because one of the kind of odd things dawned on me as I was working on this, again, is that, you know, the most people, when they think about American slavery, this is perfectly reasonable. This is not a criticism. They think about, you know, the plantations. They think about what happened in the United States. What I'm trying to suggest here is that, yes, of course, that's very important. But we also need to recognize that American slavery had this kind of transnational dimension, and that certain chapters of American slavery didn't actually take place in the United States. You know, they took place on the coast of Africa or in the Caribbean. And that this is actually, we have to understand that as part of the larger, history of American slavery. So I think that's the main thing I'd like people to take away from the book.
Now, this is going to be a question that I'm going to ask, and you may or may not want to answer it, especially given what you've just created. Is there anything new that you can share with us that you're working on at the moment?
Sure, I don't mind. I've kind of shifted gears. I'm very interested in the very, very early years of Atlantic slavery. So I've been working with some of the sources from the 15th and 16th centuries. These are in Portuguese, which I luckily read Portuguese. So if they're hard to read, I can tell you that. But I'm able to do it more or less. So I'm really kind of pursuing something on, you know, the emergence, the very earliest years of the slave trade and of Atlantic slavery, working with the Portuguese sources.
Sounds fascinating, and I cannot wait to read more once it has been translated, and you have done your analysis.
Well, the book will be in English. Then I cannot write in Portuguese very well. I can read the sources, but the book's going to be in English. That I can promise you.
Okay, then I am most definitely looking forward to another book from you, Professor Kelly. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Katrina.
Readers, listeners, please go out and pick up a copy today of American Slavers. I will say you will not regret picking up the book. And for those who are a little leery, it is highly readable. It is for academics and it is for non-academics. But you get a sense of, and as Professor Kelly said, you have a better understanding of the transnational nature of American slave trade during this period. And he goes from the 17th century through the 19th century. So you get a chance to see that change over time that happens. And also you get a sense of, when you think of New England and Rhode Island, it gives you another perspective of what is occurring in that community. So listeners, I urge you and implore you, go out today and pick up a copy of this book. It is on sale now. You will not regret it.